He first appeared as a man of mystery, under 30, with sandy red hair and a slight stoop, even though he was short. He would often ride his horse far into the countryside and tell nobody anything about it. He spoke little, in fact, and when he did, his words fell into two sharply defined patterns. For sometimes he sounded like a college professor, at other times like the roughest cowboy. And what his inherited vocabulary had been, no one could guess. He attracted the attention of the Klansmen, who were not happy with strangers moving about their domain, and several extended discussions were held concerning him, with Floyd Rusk leading the attack. "I don't want him prowling my ranch land." To Rusk's surprise, the banker said, "When he transferred his funds to us, he asked about you, Floyd." "He did. He better lay off." Things remained in this uncertain state, with Kimbrough attracting increased attention by his excursions, now here, now there, until the day when Rusk demanded that his clansmen take action. "I say we run him out of town. No place here for a man like him." But the others pointed out that he had transferred into the Larkin Bank nearly $1,000, and that amount of money commanded respect. "What do we know about him?" Rusk asked with that canny rural capacity for identifying trouble. "He boards with Nora." "The woman we tarred and feathered?" "The same." "Well," announced a third man, "he sure as hell ain't having sex with someone like her." "But it don't look good," Rusk said. "We got to keep watching." Then Kimbrough made his big mistake. From Jacksboro, he imported on the Rio bus, which ran between the two towns, a 20-year-old beauty named Esther, with painted cheeks and a flowery outfit she could not have paid for with her clerk's wages. Kimbrough moved her right into Nora's place, and on her third night of residence, the couple was visited by the Hooded Clan. "Are you two married?" "Whose business?" Kimbrough asked the question, but it could just as well have come from Esther. "It's our business. We don't allow your kind in this town." "I'm here, and so is she." "And do you think you'll be allowed to stay here?" "I sure intend to, till I get my work done." "And what is your work?" a masked figure asked. "That's my business." "Enough of this," a very fat clansman broke in. "Kimbrough, if that's your real name, you got till Thursday night to get out of town. And, miss, you, by God, better be going with him." On Tuesday and Wednesday, Dewey Kimbrough, named after the hero of Manila and just as taciturn, rode out of town on his speckled horse. Spies followed him for a while, but could only report that he rode a while, stopped a while, dismounted occasionally, then rode on. He met no one, did nothing conspicuous, and toward dusk rode back into town, where Esther and Nora had supper waiting. The three had gone to bed, Kimbrough and the girl in one room, when four hooded figures bearing whips appeared, banging on the door and calling for Kimbrough to come out. Under the hoods were Lou and Les Tumlinson, twin brothers who ran the coal and lumber business, Ed Boatwright, who had the Chevrolet agency where the dead Jake had worked, and Floyd Rusk, the big rancher. When Kimbrough refused to appear, the Tumlinson twins kicked in the door, stormed into Nora's small house, and rampaged through the rooms till they found Kimbrough and his whore in bed. Pulling him from under the covers, they dragged his small body along the hallway and through the front door. On the lawn, in about the same position as when Jake and Nora were tarred, Rusk and Boatwright had erected a cross and were in the process of igniting it when the twins shouted, "We got him!" When the cross lit up the sky, a horde of onlookers ran up, and there was so much calling back and forth among the hooded figures that the crowd knew who the four Avengers were. "That's Lou Tumlinson, for sure, and if he's here, so's his brother. The fat one we know, and I think the other has got to be Ed Boatwright." Dewey Kimbrough, who never missed anything, even when he was about to be thrashed, heard the names. He also heard the fat man say, "Strip him." And when the nightshirt was torn away and he stood naked, he heard the same man shout, "Lay it on, good." He refused to faint. He refused to cry out. In the glare of the flaming cross, he bore the first 20-odd slashes of the three whips. But then he lost count, and finally he did faint. At 9 o'clock next morning, he barged into Floyd Rusk's kitchen, and the fat man, who was an expert with revolvers from an early age, anticipated trouble and whipped out one of his big six-shooters. But before he could get it into position, he glared into the barrel of a small yet deadly German pistol pointed straight at a spot between his eyes. For a long, tense moment, the two men retained their positions. Rusk, almost ready to fire his huge revolver, Kimbrough prepared to fire first with his smaller gun. Finally, Rusk dropped his, at which Kimbrough said, "Place it right here where I can watch it," and Floyd did, sweating heavily. "Now let's sit down here, Mr. Rusk, and talk sense." When the big man took his place at the kitchen table, with his gun in reach not of himself but of Kimbrough, a conversation began which modified the history of Larkin County. "Mr. Rusk, you whipped me last night." "Now wait. You're right. You never laid a rawhide on me, but you ordered the Tumlinson twins and Ed Boatwright." Rusk's glistening of sweat became a small torrent. "I ought to kill you for that, and maybe later on I will. But right now you and I need each other, and you're far more valuable to me alive than dead." "Why?" "I have a secret, Mr. Rusk. I've had it since I was 11 years old." "Do you remember Mrs. Jackson, who ran the little store?" "Yes, I believe I do." "You wouldn't remember a boy from East Texas who spent one summer with her?" "Are you that boy?"
"I am."
"And what secret did you discover?"
"On your land, out by the tank."
"That's not my land. My father gave it to the Jaegers."
"I know. Your father promised it in the 1870s. You formalized it in 1909. So it's not my land."
Kimbrough shifted in his chair, for the pain from his whipping was intense. He had a most important statement to make, and he wanted to be in complete control when he made it. But just as he was prepared to disclose the purpose of his visit, Molly Rusk came into the kitchen, a big, blousy woman, who against all the rules of nature was pregnant. She had a round, happy face, made even more placid by the miracle of her condition. And with the simplicity that marked most of her actions, she took one look at Kimbrough and asked, "Aren't you the man they whipped last night?" And he said, "I am." She was about to ask why he was sitting in her kitchen this morning when Rusk said respectfully, "You better leave us alone, Molly." And she retired with apologies. But she had barely closed the door when she returned. "There's coffee on the stove." Then she added, "Floyd, don't do anything brutal with that gun." "True. The land is no longer yours, Mr. Rusk," Kimbrough said quietly. "Your daddy promised it to Jaeger, but when you transferred it legally, you were clever enough to retain the mineral rights." Rusk leaned far back in his chair. Then he placed his pudgy hands on the edge of the table, and from this position he sat staring at the little stranger. Finally, in an awed voice, he asked, "You mean?" Kimbrough nodded, and after readjusting his painful back, he said, "When I stayed here that summer, I did a lot of tramping about, always have."
"And what did you find at the tank?"
"A small rise that everyone else had overlooked. When I kicked rocks aside, I came upon, guess what?"
"Gold?"
"Much better, coal."
"Coal?"
"Yep. Sneaked some home, and it burned a glowing red. Kept on burning. So I kept on exploring."
"And you located a coal mine?"
"Nope. The strain was trivial, played out fast. But I covered the spot, piled rocks over it, and if you and I go out there this morning, we'll find a slight trace of coal hiding where it's always been."
"And what does this mean?"
"You don't know. I knew when I was 10, read it in a book." He shifted again.
"I read a lot, Mr. Rusk."
"And what did you read at 10? Kimbrough hesitated, then changed the subject entirely. "Mr. Rusk, I want you to enter into a deal with me right now. Word of a gentleman. We're partners. 75 to you, 25 to me."
What the hell kind of offer is that? I don't even know what we're talking about.
You will, in 2 minutes, if you make the deal.
You'd trust me after last night?
I have to.
Kimbrough banged the table. And by God, you have to trust me, too.
Is it worth my while? I have a lot of cattle, you know.
And you're losing your ass on them, aren't you?
Well, the market.
75-25 for my secret and the know-how to develop it.
Again, Rusk leaned back.
What do you know about me? Personally, I mean.
That you're a bastard through and through. But once you give your word, you stick to it.
I do.
You know, Kimbrough, when I was 14 or thereabouts, I rode to Dodge City with a...
You went to Dodge City?
I did, with the greatest trail driver Texas ever produced, R.J. Poteet. He tried to make a man of me, but I wouldn't allow it. At Dodge, I killed 2 men. Yep, age 15, I think I was.
Poteet's 2-point men spirited me out of town, just ahead of the sheriff. But on the ride back to Texas, he and his men held a kangaroo court, because they knew damned well I hadn't shot in self-defense. Found me guilty and strung me up. I thought sure as hell. He was sweating so profusely that he asked, "Can I get that towel?"
"Stay away from the gun."
They slapped the horse I was sitting on. I fell. I felt the rope bite into my neck. And then Poteet caught me. He lectured me about my wrong ways, and I spat in his face. He laughed nervously. I was scared to death, really petrified, but I wouldn't show it. Poteet went for his gun, then brushed me aside. He rocked back and forth on the kitchen chair, an immensely fat man of 47. Replacing his hands on the table, he said, "That hanging was the making of me, Kimbrough. Taught me 2 things. You've uncovered one of them. I am a man of my word, hell or high water. And I have never since then been afraid to use my gun when it had to be used. If your partner's with me, be damned careful."
"That's why I brought this," Kimbrough said, indicating the gun which he had kept trained on the fat man during their discussion.
"So what did you learn?" Rusk asked.
"Partners?" Kimbrough asked, and the two shook hands, after which the little fellow delivered his momentous information.
"At 10, I knew that coal and petroleum are the same substance in different form."
Rusk gasped. "You mean oil?"
The word echoed through the quiet kitchen as if a bomb had exploded, for the wild discoveries in East Texas had alerted the entire state to the possibilities of this fantastic substance, which made farmers multimillionaires.
"At 14, Kimbrough continued, "I studied all the chemistry and physics our little school allowed, and at 17 I enrolled at Texas A&M.
"You a college graduate?"
3 years only. By that time I knew more about petroleum than the professors. Got a job with Humble, then Gulf. Field man, sort of an informal geologist. Worked the rigs, too, so I know what drilling is. Mr. Rusk, I'm a complete oil man. But what I really am is maybe the world's greatest creekologist."
"What's that?"
"A contemptuous name the professors give practical men like me. We study the way creeks run, the rise and fall of landforms, and we guess like hell."
He slammed the table.
"But by God, we find oil. It's downright infuriating to the college people how we find oil."
"And you think you've found some on my land?"
"From the run of the creeks and the rise in your field, I'm satisfied that we're sitting near the middle of a substantial field."
"You mean real oil?"
"I do. Not a bunch of spectacular gushers like Spindletop, but good, dependable oil trapped in the rocks below us."
"If you're right, could we make some real money?"
"A fortune, if we handle it right."
"And what would right be?"
"How much of this land around here do you own?"
"I'm sure you've checked at the courthouse. Well over 7,000 acres.
"Where does it lie, relation to the tank?"
"South, and some across Bear Creek to the west."
"I'm glad you can tell the truth. But if I'm right, the field runs north and east of the tank,
Could you buy any of that land? Look, I don't have much ready cash. Could you lease the mineral rights? I mean, right now, not tomorrow, now. Is speed so necessary? The minute anyone suspects what we're up to, if they even guess that I'm a creekologist, then it's too late. How does an oil lease work? Kimbrough had to rise, adjust his scarred back, and sit gingerly on the edge of the chair. There can be three conditions of ownership. First, you own your 7,000 acres and all mineral rights under them. Second, Jaeger owns the good land we want, the surface, that is, but he owns nothing underneath. Tough on him, good for us. Yes, but do we have the right to invade his property in order to sink our well? We do, if we don't ruin his surface. And if we do ruin it, we pay him damages, and he can't do a damned thing about it. He won't like it. They never do, but that's the law. Now, the third situation is the one that operates mostly. Farmer Klein owns a big chunk of land, say 3,000 acres. He also owns the mineral rights. So we go to him and say, Mr. Klein, we want to lease the mineral rights to your land for 10 years, and we'll give you 50 cents an acre, year after year, for 10 years. A lot of money. What rights do we get? The right to drill any place on the farm, as many holes as we want, for 10 years. And what does he get? $1,500 a year, hard cash, year after year, even if we do nothing. And if we strike oil? He gets a solid 1/8 of everything we make for as long as that well produces. To eternity, if he and it last that long. Who gets the other 7/8? We do. Is it a good deal? For all of us, I mean? For Farmer Klein, it's a very fair deal. He gets an oil well without taking any risk. For you and me, the deal with Klein is about the best we can do, fair to both sides. It's his oil, but we take all the risks. And between you and me, 75-25? Tell you the truth, Rusk, with some men like me, you could get an 80-20 deal, but 9 out of 10 such men would never find a bucket of oil. I know where the oil is. For you, it's a very good deal. As for me, if I had the land or the money, I wouldn't say hello to you, but I don't have either. So what should we do? Rusk asked permission to pour some coffee, whereupon Kimbrough pushed the big revolver across the table to him. I trust you, Rusk. I have to. We're partners. When reports of the notorious Sunday school trial at Waxahachie circulated through Texas, accompanied by sardonic laughter, the voters began to realize that in Laurel Cobb, son of the famous post-Reconstruction senator, they had a man of common sense and uncommon courage, and a movement was launched to send him to Washington to assume the seat once held by his father. Said one editorial, recalling the older man's dignified performance in the chaotic 1870s, he restored honor to the fair name of Texas. Prior to 1913, Laurel would have had little chance to win the seat, for in those years, United States senators were elected by their respective state legislatures, and he would have enlisted only minor support, for he was more liberal than the Democratic leadership. In fact, his father had been acceptable in 1874 only because Texas wanted to show the rest of the nation that it was not ashamed of how it had conducted itself during the war between the states. Damn it, we want a man who held high rank in the Army of the Confederacy, and if the rest of the nation don't like it, the rest of the nation can go to hell. However, the men who sent him to Congress on those terms were often embarrassed by how he acted when he got there, and it would have been impossible for their sons to accept Laurel. But with adoption of the 17th Amendment, senators were elected by popular ballot, and the general public wanted Cobb, so a serious campaign was launched in his behalf. It was Adolphe Lacaze, the fighting little fellow who had defended him in the Sunday school trial, who persuaded Cobb to run, using this argument. If you fight for justice in a church, you can do the same in a nation. As soon as Cobb accepted this challenge, he began contesting the Democratic primary in earnest, and this took him to Saldanha County, and the machinations of Horace Vigil and his dexterous assistant, Hector Garza. Cobb, aware of Vigil's unsavory reputation, had balked at paying court to the old patron, but Lacars had quickly put an end to such revolt. "Laurel, you're one of four good Democrats who want this Senate seat, and the other three will do anything short of murder to grab it from you. The competition will be especially tough for those easy votes that Vigil keeps in his pocket. We need them, and if you have to kiss ass to get them, start bending down." How does one man control so much? Because he still has that good old Precinct 37. I should think the government would take it away. Lacars laughed. Texas tried to many times. Federals try to every time there's a Republican administration. But old Horace holds on. "Sounds illegal," Cobb said. But Lacars corrected him. "Sounds Texan." So Cobb and Lacars drove from Waxahachie along what might be called the spine of settled Texas. Waco on the Brazos, with its rich agricultural land. Temple, with its proud high school football team. Austin, with its handsome buildings and growing university. Luling and Beeville in the sun. Falfurrias, with its multitude of flowers. And then that shocking emptiness which had been the stalking ground of Ranger McNabb and the bandit Benito Garza. "It can be hot down here," Cobb groaned, as the temperature rose to 100 and stayed there. "Oh, Mr. Candidate, never say that. Down here they call a day like this bracing, and if you want their votes, you better call it bracing, too. I imagine it could be glorious in winter. Say that to everyone you meet, and you'll win." When Cobb thought he could begin to smell the river, Lacars told him, "This land up here used to be attached to Saldana County, but about 1911, huge chunks were lopped off the old counties to form new ones. But what's left is still big enough to carry a lot of weight." "What advice on handling Horace Vigil?" "Easy. Let him know you're a loyal Democrat. If you're thinking of opening a saloon, buy your beer from him. And always speak well of his Mexicans, for without their support, you will never go to Washington." As they approached the outskirts of Bravo, Cobb saw an astonishing sight. "Are those palm trees?" For mile after mile, the tall, swaying trees baked in the sun as if standing on the banks of the Nile, and sometimes in their shade would rest acres of experimental orange or grapefruit trees. In the blazing heat, a new industry was quietly expanding into Texas, and some of the farmers who had pioneered it were becoming richer than their neighbors in other parts of the state who had oil wells. "Vigil doesn't need to bother with votes. He has a paradise here," Cobb said. But Lacars warned, "Horace always bothers with votes." They found Vigil in the adobe-walled building from which he ran his beer distributorship. He was an old man now, white-haired and in his late 60s. He was markedly stooped, but no one could doubt that he was still the shrewd dictator of his county. As always, when meeting strangers, he spoke in near whispers. "Never met your daddy, but they tell me he was first rate. I heard about him tracking down that gunman who shot his two niggers. In those days, that took courage." He sat surrounded by his usual cadre of young men, sons of the functionaries who had served him in the past. They fetched his cigarettes, instructed the judge as to the cases in which Mr. Vigil had a special interest, supervised the counting of ballots, and distributed alms to the needy. Little had changed politically. Vigil was still the patron, dispensing his rude justice, and to the citizens of Saldana County he was still Señor Vigil. The old man coughed. "Mr. Cobb, of the four Democrats running for the Senate, I prefer you. Now tell me, what can I do to help you win?" Cobb liked this old dictator. He felt the man's warmth and respected his authority. "No, you tell me." "That's reasonable, because I know this territory. Not as big as it once was, but more voters, more leverage." He turned away from Cobb and called to his principal assistant. "Hector, I want you to meet the man we're sending to Washington to take his daddy's place." and the four laid plans for nailing down the primary. But as Cobb toured other sections of the state, he became aware that one of his opponents was taking his own bold steps to steal the election. And this embittered Adolf Lacaze, who reminded Cobb, "We've got to get a huge majority in Saldanha County, because, as the papers keep saying, in Texas, winning the Democratic primary is tantamount to election." You ever think about that word, Adolf? It's one of those curious cases in which a perfectly good word has been restricted to only one use. You never hear, "A hot dog is tantamount to a sausage." Lacaze, irritated that his candidate was wasting his time on such non-political reflection, warned, "You better hope this primary is tantamount to your election." The campaign in Saldanha had only begun when one of those political events which perplexed outsiders took place. Horace Vigil, who had fought the Republican customs officer Tim Koch for decades, learned that his old nemesis was leaving the Bravo Escandon Bridge for a better job in New York. So he organized a gala farewell to which he contributed a new Chevrolet in which the Kochs could drive to their new post. In his speech of thanks, Koch said, "I hate to leave Saldanha just as the Democrats are preparing to tear themselves apart in their primary. I'd like to see my old friend Horace get his nose busted. But I say this here and now. I want all my Republicans to cross party lines and get into the polling booths one way or another. And you're to vote for Vigil's man, Laurel Cobb, and vote three or four times like you always did for me. Because in 30 years of fighting that sumbitch Vigil, I always had respect for him. I never knew what infamous or criminal thing he was going to hit me with next, but the battles were fun. I look forward with relief to fighting those Democratic hoodlums in Tammany Hall. They're the worst snakes ever got thrown out of Ireland. But these damn Democrats in Texas, they're rattlesnakes." 3 days before the election, Lacaze slipped back into Bravo for a strategy meeting, and what he learned was ominous. Vigil himself outlined the sorry details. "Reformers in Washington, bunch of Republicans, they're coming down to take control of Precinct 37. We've got to have those votes. We'll be allowed to count them and report whatever totals we need. Texas law demands that. But as soon as the counting ends, we have to deliver the ballot boxes to the Federals. What do you think they'll do? Send me to jail if they can prove anything." Lacaze could see that this possibility frightened the old man, who said quietly, "Jail I do not seek, but if it's the only way we can win this election, jail it will have to be. Our friends will never let that happen." The old warrior was not so confident, but he did not lament his problems. He had one more election to win, and he would speak only of it. "When the boxes reach Bravo, they'll recount the votes in the presence of a federal judge. We could be in a lot of trouble. Have you a plan for getting out of this?" "Normally, we'd bribe the judge, but this time he's a federal. I'll think of something." A council of war occupied Saturday afternoon, and it was Hector Garza, a little taller, a little bolder than his predecessors, who devised the winning strategy. "We must have absolute secrecy, so that when the Federals come after us, we can honestly swear, we don't know." "You think they will come?" Vigil asked in a whisper, and Garza said, "For sure, the Republicans will see to that. But I know a way to hold them off." Sharing his intricate plan with no one, not even Vigil, he orchestrated a strategy in which no one except he and the person performing one small part of the job knew what anyone else was doing. On the eve of the election, he said to Vigil and Lacaze with confidence, "As soon as the votes have been counted across the state, tell me how many votes we'll need to win." Late on election night, Vigil telephoned Garza, standing watch at Precinct 37. "We've got to have more than 410. And an hour later, the three officials at the precinct certified the vote to have been 422-7. When the men from Washington, waiting in Bravo, heard this, they exulted. "Now we have them. Impossible for a vote to be so lopsided." and almost hungrily they waited to get their hands on the incriminating box. This time Vigil goes behind bars and not in some half-baked county jail, the federal pen. But now a singular thing happened. The ballot box disappeared. Yes, on its way down FM 117, it disappeared. And since the elections officials had legally reported their results, those results had to stand. The preposterous 422-7 stood, enabling Laurel Cobb to win the election by a 27-vote margin. How could an object as big as a ballot box disappear? It was never fully explained. It had been handed by the judges to a Mr. Hernandez, who passed it along to a Mr. Robles, who gave a receipt for it, and he gave it to a Mr. Solorzano, and that was where it disappeared, because Mr. Solorzano could prove that he had been in San Antonio when all this happened. Texas newspapers, which had supported one or another of Cobb's opponents, screamed for an investigation, while the more impartial journals in New York and Washington editorialized that the time had come to cleanse American politics of the stigma of Saldanha County. However, the case became somewhat more complicated when it was revealed that the mysterious Mr. Solorzano had been in the employ of the Washington Men. Hector Garza revealed to no one his role in this ledger domain. But Horace Vigil, in a show of righteous morality, did issue a pious statement deploring the carelessness of the men, whose ineptness had allowed aspersions to be cast upon the fine officials of Precinct 37. I personally regret the loss of that box, because had its contents been counted by the federal judge, the results would have proved what I have always claimed. The election officials of Precinct 37 are honest. They're just a mite slow. This time, their tardiness enabled a good man to go to Washington. On a gray morning in October 1922, schoolboys sitting near the window cried, "Look at what's coming!" And their classmates ran to see three large trucks moving down the Jacksboro Road. They carried long lengths of timber, piles of pipe, and 10 of the toughest-looking men Larkin County had seen in a long time. Two lads who had been reading science magazines shouted, "Oil rig!" And in that joyous, frenzied cry, the Larkin boom was born. The trucks rolled into Courthouse Square, pulled up before the sheriff's office, and asked where Larkin Tank was. Then, consulting the maps they had been given, they headed north toward the land whose surface was owned by the Yeagers, but whose mineral rights were still controlled by Floyd Rusk. No sooner had the three trucks left town than Rusk appeared in his pickup, accompanied by Dewey Kimbrough, and when the new newspaper editor shouted, "What's up?" Rusk cried back, "We're spudding in an oil well." Much of the town followed the trucks out to a marked depression east of the tank where Rusk No. 1 was to be dug. And what they saw became the topic of conversation for many days. Because when Paul Yeager, 49 years old and soft-spoken, saw the three men in the lead truck preparing to open his gate and drive onto his land, he ran forward to protest. "This is Yeager land. Keep off." "We know it's Yeager land. We've been looking for it." And the truck started to roll toward the opened gate. "I warned you to stop," Yeager cried, his voice rising. "Mister, it ain't for you to say." And in the next frantic moments, with Yeager trying to halt the trucks, the people of Larkin learned a lot about Texas law. "Mr. Yeager," the man in charge of the drilling rig explained, "the mineral rights to this here land reside with Mr. Floyd Rusk, and he's asked us..." "Here's Rusk now. Floyd, what in hell?" "Drillin' rig, Paul. We think there may be oil under this land." "You can't come in here." "Yes, we can. The law says so." "I don't believe it." "You better check, because we're coming in." "You can't bring those big trucks through my crops." "Yes, we can, Paul, so long as we compensate you for any damage. The law says so." And with that, huge Floyd Rusk gently pushed his brother-in-law aside so that the three trucks could drive in, make a rocky path through the field, and come to a halt at the site decided upon intuitively by the creekologist Dewey Kimbrough. A lawyer hired by Yeager did come out to contest Rusk's right to invade another man's property and destroy some of its crop, but reference to Texas law quickly satisfied him that Rusk had every right to do just what he was doing. He's protected, Paul. Law's clear on that. So the town watched as Rusk number one was started in the hollow, and the efficiency of the crew dazzled the watchers. For the men, using an old-style system popular in the 1910s, set to work like a colony of purposeful ants, digging the foundations for the rig, lining the tanks into which the spill would be conserved for analysis, and erecting the pyramidal wooden derrick, which would rise 70 feet in the air, that consoling feature of the Texas landscape which proclaimed, "There may be oil here." When the pulley shivs were fixed atop the derrick and the cables rove through them, the men were ready to affix one end of the cable to the huge drum that raised and lowered it, the other end to the cutting bit that would be dropped downward with considerable force to dig the hole. The rig, when set, would not drill into the earth in any rotary fashion. By the sheer force of falling weight, the bit would pulverize its way through rock. And how was this repetitive fall of the 2-ton bit assembly controlled? See that heavy wooden beam that's fixed at one end, free at the end over the hole? We call it the walking beam, and every time it lifts up, it raises all the heavy tools in the hole. When it releases, bam, down they crash, smashing the rock to bits. The townspeople could not visualize the force exerted at the end of that drop, nor the effectiveness of the tools used to crush the rock. But after the walking beam had operated for about 2 hours, the man in charge of the rig signaled for the cutting bit to be withdrawn from the hole. And now the ponderous process was reversed, with the cables pulling the heavy tools up out of the hole, so that the worn bit at the end which had done the smashing could be removed to be resharpened, while a replacement, keen as a heavy knife, was sent down to resume the smashing. "What did they do with the old one?" a garage mechanic asked. And he was shown a kind of blacksmith shed in which 2 strong men with 18-pound sledges heated the worn bit and hammered it back into cutting shape. And that was the basic process which the people of Larkin studied with such awe. Sharpen the bit, attach it to the string of tools, raise it high on the cable, lower it into the hole, then work the walking beam, and allow the sharp edge to smash down on the rock until something gave. Then undo the whole package, fit on a new bit, resharpen the old, and hammer away again. To the newspaper editor, who wanted to share with his readers the complexity of the process, the rig boss said, "One bit can drill 30 feet, more if it encounters shale. But when it hits really hard sandstone or compacted limestone, 3 feet, we have to take it out and resharpen." Where does the water come from that I see going into the tank? If we're lucky, the hole lubricates itself. If not, we pump water in. The bottom has to be kept wet so that the bit can bite in. Besides, we have to bring up samples. And he showed the newsman how a clever tool called the baler was let down into the hole from which the drilling bit had been removed. It has this trick at the bottom. Push it against the bottom and water swirls inside. Let it rise, it closes off the tube. Then pull it up on the cable and dump it into the slush pit. When the newsman looked at the big square hole the crew had prepared, 30 feet on a side, 10 inches deep, he thought that the waste water was being discarded. "Oh, no, look at that fellow, one of the most important men we have. He samples every load of water. What kind of rock? What consistency? What kind of sand?" "Why?" "It's his job to paint a picture of the inside of our well, every different layer, if he can do it, because only then do we know what we have." The operation of the rig, 24 hours a day, was so compelling, with men delving into the secrets of the earth, lining the hole with casing to keep it open, cementing sections of the hole, fishing like schoolboys for parts which had broken and lodged at the bottom, calculating the tilt of the rocks and their composition, that it became a fascinating game which preoccupied all of Larkin and much of Texas, for it was known throughout the oil industry that Rusk No. 1, west of Jacksboro, is down to 1,800 feet, stone dry. Spectators learned new words, which they bandied deftly. They're under-reaming at 2,000. They've cemented in at 2,002. And always there was the hope that on this bright morning the word would flash, Rusk No. 1 has come in. But the town was also involved in something equally colorful, for the 10 roughnecks who had come with the rig were proving themselves to be of a special breed, the likes of which Larkin had never before seen. Rugged, powerful of arm, incredibly dirty from the slop of the rig, impatient with anyone who was not connected with the drilling business, they were among the ablest professionals in the country. The three top experts had come down from the oil fields of Pennsylvania, where their forebears had been drilling for oil since 1859, when Colonel Drake brought in that first American well at Titusville. He had struck his bonanza at a mere 69 feet. The next echelon were Texas men, who had worked in Arkansas and Louisiana in years when activity focused there. But the men who gave the crew character were Texans who had worked only in this state. They were violent, cat-like men, who knew they could lose a finger or an arm if they dallied with the flashing cable or did not jump quickly enough if something went wrong with the walking beam. On the job, they were self-disciplined, for if even one man failed to perform, the safety of all might be imperiled. But off the job, they wanted things their way, and what they wanted most was booze, women, and a good poker game. This brought them into conflict with the Ku Klux Klan, which had disciplined Larkin along somewhat divergent lines. And the trouble started when three of the men imported high-flying ladies from Fort Griffin and set them up at Nora's place, where the Creekologist Dewey Kimbrough and his girl Esther still maintained quarters. Within two nights, the Klansmen learned of the goings-on, and in their hoods, three of them marched out to Nora's to put a stop to this frivolity. But they were met by the three roughnecks who said, "What is this shit? Take off your nightshirts." "We're warning you. Get those girls out of town by Thursday night or face the consequences." "You come out here again in those nightshirts, you're going to get your ass blown off. Now get the hell out of here." The Klansmen returned on Thursday night, as promised, but the three sponsors of the girls were on the night shift, so the protectors of morality satisfied themselves by having the three girls arrested and hauling them off to jail. When the oil men reached Nora's after a hard night on the rig, they expected a little companionship, but instead found Nora weeping. "They warned me that if the girls ever came back, and that included Esther, they was gonna burn the place down." The oil men, collecting the other two from their shift, marched boldly to the jail and informed the custodian there, not the sheriff, that if he didn't deliver those girls in 3 minutes, they were going to blow the place apart. He turned them loose, and with considerable squealing and running, the eight rioters, three girls, five oil men, roared back to Nora's, where they organized a morning party with Esther. The Klan met that night to decide what to do about the invaders, and many of the men looked to Floyd Rusk for guidance. "What I say is, let's get the well dug. If we find oil like Kimbrough assures me we will, we'll all have enough money to settle other questions later." When there was grumbling at such temporizing, he said, "You know me, I'm a law and order man." "There ain't much law and order when a gang of roughnecks can raid our jail and turn loose our prisoners." "Oil men are different," Rusk said, and there the matter rested. For in Texas, when morality was confronted by the possibility of oil, it was the former which had to give, for a while. Dewey Kimbrough had guessed wrong on Rusk No. 1. It went to 3,000 feet and was still stone dry. So the great Larkin oil boom went bust. But it was not a wasted effort, for at 2,300 feet, Dewey had spotted in the slush pond indications of the Strawn sand formation, which excited him enormously. Sharing the information only with Rusk, he said, "Let them think we missed. Then buy up as many leases as we can west of our dry number one, because Strawn is promising." So, wearing his poor mouth, Rusk went to one landowner after another, saying, "Well, looks like the signs deceived us, but maybe over the long haul." He offered to take their mineral leases off their hands at 25 cents an acre, and when he had vast areas locked up, he asked Kimbrough, "Now what?" "I'm dead certain we have a major concentration down there. I see evidences of it wherever I look. It's got to be there, Mr. Rusk." "But where?" "That's the problem. East of number one or west. I can't be sure which." "Your famous gut feeling? What's it say?" Kimbrough drove Rusk out to the area and showed him how Rusk number one had lain at the bottom of a dip. "It's the land formations west of here that set my bells ringing. Damn, I do believe our field is hiding down there, below the first concentration of Strawn sand, like maybe 3,000 feet. We have money for only one more try. Where should it be?" "I am much inclined toward the tank," and he indicated a spot close to the statue which sentimentalists had erected to mark the spot where the lovers Nellie Miner and Jim Logan had committed suicide by drowning. That was the legend now. But Rusk objected to digging there. "The women in town would raise hell if we touched that place." So they moved farther west. And finally, on a slight rise, Dewey scraped his heel in the dust. "Rusk number two, and I know it'll be good." When he said this, Rusk asked, "If you know so much, why don't the big boys? They have their spies here, you know." "The big companies depend on little men like me to find oil for them. Then they move in fast. We get our small profit. They get their big haul." "I want the big haul, Kimbrough." "So do I. So let's drill over here, where I've marked Rusk number two." "That's on Jaeger's land." "But it's in your mineral rights." "We'll have trouble if we go back again." "Laws on our side." So Rusk number two was started, with the same drilling team and the same girls staying at Nora's. When there was still a good chance for oil, even the clan had to adjust. With scouts from 9 large companies watching every move Dewey Kimbrough made, Floyd Rusk drilled a second dry hole at 3,100 feet. And now his money began to run out. He had invested most of his ready cash in hiring the drilling crew, and a good portion of his savings in buying up leases. But when the crunch came, Dewey Kimbrough, like a true wildcatter, wanted to risk more money. "Mr. Rusk, so help me God, what we must do is acquire more leases. If you have to pawn your wife's wedding ring, do it and get those leases. They'll be dirt cheap now." "People are laughing at us, but they don't know what we know." "And what's that?" "More signs of oil. I saw them myself when I took the samples at 2,900 feet. "Was that significant?" "Significant? My God, don't you realize what I'm saying? On Rusk number one, we found indications at 2,300 feet. Now, over here at Rusk number two, we find it at both 2,300 and 2,900. Means that oil is down there somewhere. My judgment is our next well has got to hit. I know the field must lie between number one and number two, and we've got to get those leases." "You find the money. I don't have any more." So Dewey Kimbrough set out to con the entire state of Texas into supporting his wild dream of an oil field north of Larkin, in an area which had never produced a cup of oil. He hectored his friends from his student days at A&M, and young men who specialized in the practical courses offered there often did well, so they had money, but they refused to risk it. He badgered his oil acquaintances from the eastern fields, but they knew from their own studies that Larkin held no promise. And he buttonholed any gambler who had ever taken a chance on Texas oil, traveling as far as Nevada and Alabama to trace them. He was, of course, only one of several hundred visionaries who were flogging the Texas dream that year. Some crazies were trying to convince their friends that there had to be oil in unlikely places like Longview, Borger, and Mentone. Others claimed that the area north of Fort Stockton had to have oil, and 100 others lobbied for places of their choice where oil would never be found. It was a time of oil fever, and no one had the malady more virulently than Dewey Kimbrough. Except perhaps Floyd Rusk. For when the fat man realized that all his savings and even his ranch were committed to this adventure, he became monomaniacal about bringing in the field that Dewey kept assuring him existed under the leases which he already controlled. He was determined to see this exploration through, for he had convinced himself that he could recognize the formations when Kimbrough pointed them out. Millions upon millions of years ago, a lake of oil had been trapped down there among the sandstone and the limestone tilts, and he wanted it. But he had no money. Digging the 2 dry holes had exhausted his funds, and with Kimbrough finding little success in borrowing replacements, he did not know where to turn. But one morning, when the drillers said they wanted to haul their rig back east to more promising sites, and would do so unless paid promptly, he went to the one person in whom he did not wish to confide. Emma Larkin Rusk, the one-time prisoner of the Comanche, was 66 that year, a frail shadow weighing not much over 100 pounds. The stubs of her ears showed beneath the wisps of hair that no longer masked her deformity, and her balsa wood nose seemed to fit less properly now that she had lost so much weight. But she was alert, and already knew that her difficult son was in trouble. "My first 2 wells were dry," he said. "I know. But we're sure the next one will hit." "Why don't you drill it?" "No money." "None. Not a dime." "And you want me to lend you some?" "Yes." She sat with her hands folded, staring at her unlovely son, this glutton who had never done anything right. When she had hoped to make a man of him through R.J. Poteet, he had fumbled the opportunity. And when in 1901, after her husband's death, she had turned over the operation of the ranch to him, he had bungled it so badly that she had to step back in and save it. Now he wanted to borrow her life savings, the funds which allowed her to live in her own house, rather than impose on him and Molly. There was no sensible reason why she should lend this grotesque man the money he wanted, but there was an overpowering sentimental one. He had carved the nose she wore, and which had made such a difference in her life. And although their relationship had been a miserable one, she loved him for that one gesture. She had known great terror in her life, and little love apart from that which her daydreaming husband had given so freely. So she cherished every manifestation made in her behalf. Floyd was her son, and at one accidental point in his miserable life he had loved her. She would lend him the money. But life had made her a wily woman, so before she relinquished her funds, she drove a bargain. When he asked her, "What interest?" she said, "None," and he thanked her. Then she added, "But I do want 5,000 more acres for my longhorns." And since he was in the perilous position of having to accept any terms in order to get his gambling money, he said, "Promised." And she asked, "Fenced in?" And he had to reply, "Yes." However, when they went out to inspect the land she had thus acquired for her chosen animals, she saw that the proposed rig was going to stand very close to the statue commemorating the 2 lovers, and Floyd expected her to raise the devil. Instead, she stood quietly and looked at the unassembled derrick. "How appropriate," she said. "They lived in turbulence. Better than most, they'll adjust to an oil boom, if we get one. I'm sure they hope you hit, Floyd, I do." And so, with his mother's money, Rusk kept his gamble alive. Then began the days of anxiety. Even with Emma's contribution, the partnership lacked enough funds to start drilling its third well, the one that seemed likely to produce. And this meant that the ill-assorted team, gross, surly Floyd and tenacious, rat-like Dewey, faced double disasters. The leases on the very promising land which they had taken for only 1 year were about to run out, and the drilling crew was eager to move east. The partners knew they had less than 2 months to resolve these problems. The nature of a Texas oil lease was this. If a lease expired on the 30th of June, 1923, as these did, the holder had a right to start drilling at his choice of time up to 1 minute before midnight on the 30th. If he did not or could not start, the lease lapsed and could be resold to some other wildcatter. But if the holder did start his drilling within his time allowance, the full provisions of the lease came into effect and prevailed for centuries to come. So each of the partners, in his own way, began to scrounge around for additional funds. Rusk stayed in Larkin, badgering everyone, begging them to lend him money. And he was embittered when his Ku Klux Klan compatriots turned him down. Some did so out of conviction, because they felt it was his greed that had brought the 10 oil field roughnecks, with their devil-driven ways, into Larkin. But most rejected him because they saw him to be a burly, aggressive, overbearing man who deserved to get his comeuppance. Kimbrough, on the other hand, traveled widely, still hoping to find the speculator who would grubstake him for the big attack on the hidden field. He would go anywhere, consult with anyone, and offer almost any kind of inducement. "Let me have the money, less than a year, 10% interest, and I'll give you 1/32nd of my participation." He offered 1/16th, even 1/8th, but found no takers. When he returned to Larkin in April 1923, he was almost a defeated man. But because he was a born wildcatter, he could not let anyone see his despair. Each morning when he was in town, he repaired to the greasy café where the oilmen, who had begun to infiltrate the area, assembled to make their big boasts. And he knew it was essential that they see him at the height of his confidence. "We expect to start number 3 any day now. Big investors from Tulsa, you know." But each day that passed brought the partnership closer to collapse. Now the serious gambling started, the reckless dealing away of percentages. One morning, Floyd rushed to the café, took Dewey into the men's room, and almost wept. "The drilling crew is hauling their rig back to Jacksboro. We can't let them do that. Once they get off our land, we'll never get them back." So the partners, smiling broadly as if they had concluded some big deal in the toilet, walked casually through the café, nodding to the oil men, then dashed out to the rig. Rusk had been right. The men were starting to dismantle it prior to mounting it on trucks. But when Dewey cried, "Wait, we'll give you 1/16th of our 7/8ths," they agreed to take the chance, for they too had seen the strong signs. Later, Rusk asked, "Could we afford to give so much?" And Dewey explained the wildcatter's philosophy. "If the well proves dry, who gives a damn what percentage they have? And if it comes in big, like I know it will, who cares if they have their share?" A week before the termination of the leases, the partners still had insufficient funds to drill their well. But now Kimbrough heard from two of his A&M gamblers who wanted to get in on the action. But to get their money, he had to give away 1/8 of his share to the first friend, 1/16th to the other, and the final ownership of the well became so fractionized that the partners could scarcely untangle the proportions. 3 days before the leases expired, scandal struck the operation. For the two A&M men, always a canny lot, heard the rumor that their old buddy Dewey Kimbrough had pulled an oil field sting on them, and they rode into town ready to tear him apart. He sold 200% of his well, peddled it all over East Texas. "What's that mean?" the Larkin men asked. "Don't you see? If he drills dry, and he's already done so twice, he owes us nothing. He's collected twice, spends about 1/4 of the total, and goes off laughing with our dough." They drove out to the proposed drilling site at the tank to challenge Kimbrough. But when they found him hiking back and forth over the rolling terrain, trying to settle upon the exact spot for his final well, they found him honestly engaged in trying to find oil. He had not sold 200% of what he knew was going to be a dry well. He was gambling his entire resources upon one lucky strike. And as Texas gamblers, they were satisfied to be sharing in his risk. 2 days before the lapse of their leases, Rusk and Kimbrough finally got a break. An Oklahoma wildcatting outfit had figured that if Dewey Kimbrough, once of Humble and Gulf, thought there was oil in the Larkin area, it was a good location in which to take a flyer. They had drilled a well just to the east of Rusk No. 1, gambling that the suspected oil lay in that direction and not toward the tank. These men, of course, could not know that Dewey had struck indications to the west. So down they went to 5,000 feet, missing the field entirely and producing nothing but a very dry well, whose failure they announced on June 28th. This helped Kimbrough in two ways. It verified his hunch that the field did not lie to the east of Rusk No. 1, and it so disheartened the Larkin landowners, three test holes, three buckets of dust, that they became determined to offload their worthless leases throughout the entire area. In a paroxysm of energy, Dewey shouted at Rusk and his two A&M buddies, "Now's the time to pick up every damned lease in the district. My God, won't somebody lend me $10,000? Faced by total disaster if his Rusk No. 3 did not come in, he spent 2 days committing his last penny to his belief that he would strike it rich this time. By dint of telegrams, telephone calls, and the most ardent personal appeals to speculators in the Larkin, Jacksboro, Fort Griffin area, he put together a substantial kitty, which he spent on leases that encapsulated the field. At 6 in the morning of the 30th of June, 1923, Dewey Kimbrough appeared at the Oil Men's Café with a smile so confident and casual that a stranger might think he was about to start a well with the full weight of Gulf oil behind him. And when Floyd Rusk came in, sweating like a pig, Dewey caught him by the wrist and whispered, "Dry your face." For he, Dewey, had been in such perilous situations before. Rusk had not. When they rode out to the field, with Dewey commenting on the brightness of this summer's day, Rusk was vaguely aware that if Rusk No. 3 did strike oil, profits would be divided in this typically Texan way, the intricate details of which had been worked out by lawyers and filed in long legal documents. Participants: owner of mineral rights, standard lease, 1/8. Legal division, 0.125000. Actual split of all income, 0.125000. Rusk and Kimbrough for their enterprise, 7/8. Legal division, 0.875000. Total, 1. But Rusk and Kimbrough split their 7/8. Drilling team for staying on job, 1/16. Legal division, 0.054688. Actual split of all income, 0.054688. Rusk and Kimbrough will share 15/16. Legal division, 0.820313. Total, 0.875001. Rusk and Kimbrough split their 0.820313. Rusk, 3/4. Legal division, 0.615235. Kimbrough, 1/4. Legal division, 0.205078. Total, 0.820313. But Rusk must split his 0.615235. Emma Rusk, 1/4. Legal division, 0.153809. Actual split of all income, 0.153809. Floyd Rusk, 3/4. Legal division, 0.461426. Actual split of all income, 0.464126. Total, 0.615235. And Kimbrough must split his 0.205078. A&M First Investor, 1/8. Legal division, 0.025635. Actual split of all income, 0.025635. A&M Second Investor, 1/16. Legal Division, 0.012817. Actual split of all income, 0.012817. Kimbrough, 13/16. Legal Division, 0.166626. Actual split of all income, 0.166626. Total Legal Division, 0.205078. Total actual split of all income, 1.000001. Thus, the second A&M investor was entitled to 7/8 times 15/16 times 1/4 times 1/16 of the whole, or 105/8192, 0.012817, which meant that every time the well produced $100,000, he received $1,281.74 for as long as the well operated. On an August afternoon in 1923, a hanger-on who had watched the drilling of Rusk No. 3 as he would a baseball game came riding back to Larkin in his Ford, screaming, "They got oil!" The citizens, hoping to see a great gusher sprouting from the plains, sped out to the tank, where on its flank hardened men were dancing and crying and slapping each other with oil-splattered hands. They did not have a gusher. The famous field at Larkin did not contain either the magnitude or the subterranean pressure to provide that kind of spectacular exhibition. But Dewey Kimbrough, seeing the oil appear and making such guesses as he could on fragmentary evidence, said, "Could be 110 barrels a day for years to come." He was right. The Larkin field, as it came to be known, was going to be a slow, steady producer. Spacious in extent, but not very deep, it was the kind of field that would allow wells to be dug almost anywhere inside its limits, with the sober assurance that at around 3,000 feet in the strawn sand, a modest amount of oil would be forthcoming, year after year after year. "And the glory of it is," Kimbrough told Rusk when they were back home at midnight, "we know pretty well the definition of the field. Our first dry well to the east, plus the dry Oklahoma Wildcatter, showed us where it ends in that direction. Our dry number 2 proved where it ends in the west. What we don't know is how far north and south." "Forever," Rusk said, "and by God we control it all." For one glorious moment, these two men who had once wanted to kill each other danced in the darkened kitchen.